Hello everyone, this is Giulio Coraggio, location head of the Italian Department of Intellectual Property and Technology at the law firm DLA Piper. This is the podcast Diritto al Digitale, and today I'm honored to have as our special guest Dan Nishita. Dan is the head of the cabinet for Dragos Tudarashe, member of the European Parliament, and more importantly for our discussion, one of the rapporteurs of the EU AI Act. Dan, thank you very much for accepting my invite and for your availability.
Thank you, Giulio. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Dan, I cannot start this discussion without asking you what happened during those 36 hours of negotiations last December. I mean, I heard some comments they're gonna publish a Netflix series on those negotiations. I mean, what was happening during those hours?
Well, look, you probably know, and your followers know as well, but I'll just spend 10 seconds on the process. So basically, European law is made by European Commission proposing a law, then Parliament and Council working in parallel to amend that law, depending on their priorities. Then they meet in what is called a trialogue, where all three institutions negotiate the text. So that was why we met. Now, indeed, we broke some records, and we're very proud that, it was a historical trialogue. But there was a good reason behind it. This is a very complex text. You know, we're regulating something new, something that is, you know, we're just beginning to understand as lawmakers. And I say that, with all honesty, it's a very complex technology and we want to get it right. So when we went in there, we had negotiated for months and months the text. Nevertheless, there were so many open questions, so many moving parts, that the only chance to actually get a solid text that would actually serve our interest in the European Union was to dedicate the time necessary to go through every single one of the issues that were important and to make sure we get to a political agreement. Because so many of them work together. If you get something wrong in one part of the text, then everything else falls apart, also in terms of the political agreement between the institutions, but also within the institutions. So it was good. It was very intense. Everybody negotiated very, very hard. And in these negotiations, you don't just sit one in front of the other and you go one by one. You have breakouts. People are getting stressed. There's excitement, and you find the solution. Then you go back and you sit down and you negotiate again. So we've done that. As you said, it was 36 hours. I think I actually would say 37 because we had a preparatory meeting one of the mornings, but nobody counted that. But anyway, it was really good.
Yeah, to the eyes of a lawyer, it looked like the final negotiation of a deal where you are working on fine-tuning the text. And it is unbelievable that politicians, technical experts were all discussing about how to to amend the text to meet, obviously, the needs of all the political parties. And then in the following month, there were meetings of technical experts, and hopefully we are close to a final text. One of the major questions around the opportunity of the AI Act then is obviously, why do we need a legislation now? Is it really fostering innovation within the European Union? Or on the other hand, it's going to restrain the EU market and make it less competitive. Just for those that haven't read the current version of the AI Act, it's a risk-based legislation. The basic AI systems cover a very large category of AI solutions, but then we have high risk AI systems, we have general purpose AI systems, and we have general purpose AI systems with systemic that can generate a systemic risk. So what is your view as to the result that was achieved? Will this really lead to the flourishing of the EU market in artificial intelligence?
Well, look, this is the question that I love the most, because, of course, everybody asks it. And there's such a simple, but, you know, it's probably going to take me a minute or two for it, answer. That is, when the European Union, and here I'm defending or presenting the views of, you know, the higher powers, right? When the European Union started thinking about AI, we realized, okay, this technology is super important for, you know, for the future, for our economy, for the European market. So how are we going to benefit the most from it? So the starting point, the strategic thinking is, let's benefit from artificial intelligence. Now, in that, we had two questions. One is, you know, how do you build the what the Commission calls the ecosystem of excellence? That is, how do you encourage innovation, support startups? How do you encourage, you know, the development of European AI? And on the other hand, you have the question of adoption and trust. So how do you build trust? How do you build that ecosystem of trust? The AI Act comes to fill this part, the ecosystem of trust. That is, it wants to make AI technology more trustworthy. And how do you do that? You make sure that when it is presenting risks, only when, then you the those who build artificial intelligence have a certain number of obligations that will make those systems less risky. And here we're talking about risks to health, safety, and fundamental rights, right? We're talking about risks of discrimination, risks of biases, risks of making decisions that affect people's lives that would be detrimental to them. So the AI Act, while it is a very important piece of legislation, and it's the first of its kind in the European Union, deals mostly with those systems that can pose risks. So if you build an AI, for example, in agriculture, there's absolutely nothing that the AI Act has to do with you. It's really setting rules for those systems, for example, that are used by police forces, that are used by immigration authorities, that are used in deciding on whether somebody gets a job or not, or social benefits. So only these high risk, as we call them, use cases are governed by artificial intelligence Act. Then, of course, you have, with new developments in artificial intelligence, you have the very, very powerful AI, such as the big models that we've all heard of, ChatGPT, Bard, but also others that are, you know, in the making, that are not necessarily high risk, as in they make a decision on whether or not you get a job or not, or you get hired, or you get detained at the border or not. Nevertheless, these, because they are so powerful and they can be used by such large segments of society, can present systemic risk. So they fall in the same logic. If you don't present a risk, you're fine. If you present a systemic risk in this case, that is, you know, a threat to democracy, for example, or a threat to the stability of the economy, then you also need to make your system safe. So going back to what I was exposing, and we can go into details how the AI Act balances innovation on one hand and this protection of health, safety, fundamental rights. But going back to what I was saying, the logic of the AI Act is, once you make those systems safer by following the rules, then you can go to market with them. You can use them. You can deploy them in the European Union, and they're more trustworthy. Therefore, you get more adoption. So basically, the AI Act resolves some of the questions that we might have as a society in terms of the dangers or the risks of AI. It doesn't regulate all of AI. It just pinpoints to, okay, these might be problematic. Let's fix those so that we have more trust, more adoption. And it goes hand in hand with the innovation package, with the investments, with everything that is on the other side in the ecosystem of excellence. So they really are complementary. It's not just one law to govern AI in Europe and we're done. Bam. We're not doing anything else. I can go more into the things that we're doing in terms of supporting AI if you want, like the recently announced AI factories, opening up the supercomputers to startups and SMEs. There's going to be a lot of investment in AI and in supporting this a lot more. But, you know, I don't want to
deviate
from your question.
Absolutely. I do agree with you that when there was a need to regulate, the EU legislator did. It's also true that impacts sectors like the banking sector and the insurance sector, because when there is AI used for credit scoring or for pricing in insurance policies, then in that is considered as a high risk AI system. But as you said, in that case, the EU legislator considered that there was a risk for the individual because of the amount of data that.
And a very, very simple, you know, example of this is, you know, what if I'm a poor Black immigrant female and the system takes that into account and, you know, my loan rate is, you know, much higher than that of the average person. My risk profile is determined based on the color of my skin and on my immigration status or on me being a female. So, but what the AI Act does is says when you build those systems, make sure you take that into account. That's all it does.
Yeah. Then another point that was heavily discussed was how to balance obligations that had to be on the providers of AI solutions, just to make some examples, ChatGPT or for it would be OpenAI or for it might be Microsoft for Copilot, and those of the deployers that are those that actually use this technology. We might be an industrial company, a bank, or an insurance company that just adopt the technology. The final text seems to place considerably more obligations on developers, but there is an obligation to monitor compliance on the side of the deployers. How do you think in practice this is going to work? Because obviously the providers of very powerful AI solutions are not so many. Well, at the moment are really a very limited number of players in the market. So how do you think it's going to work in practice, or basically all the risk is going to end up on the deployers that will not have negotiating power?
Well, that's exactly why we put most of the obligations on the providers, right? So most of the obligations are at the stage where you build the system and you're thinking about placing it on the European market. You need to be compliant once you place the system on the European market. That is, you know, you sell it to a deployer. And if the provider is not compliant, then it is the provider that would be, you know, under the scope of the AI Act and under, you know, the pain of penalties that we have put in there for non-compliance. So, and I think it keeps with product safety legislation in the EU in general, it is, you know, once you build a product and you put it on the market, you need to follow these rules. But of course, our goal in the AI Act is to, you know, protect, as I said, you know, health, safety, fundamental rights. And in order to achieve that, we also need to take into account that some systems can be very well built And I'm not talking here about GPT, that's, you know, the models and the other discussion, but you can have a startup that builds a very good system that does, I don't know, facial recognition, for example, right? The context in which you use that system matters. So if you buy it to organize your own photos on your computer, right, for a personal use, as a deployer, you don't really have that much of an impact on the fundamental rights of people than if you use it to identify suspects in a, you know, criminal proceeding, right? Two different uses of the same system. Let's assume the system is compliant, but it's also the deployer that matters. So that's why we have certain obligations for certain deployers, mostly those deployers that are public institutions or that provide research and essential services. It's again, you know, it's not your private company who's going to buy the software and has multiple obligations other than, as you said, checking that, of course, the system is compliant. Because look, it's the same with every product, right? You know, you can't buy counterfeit goods and use them and pretend that, you know, okay, this is all okay. You have to check, okay, is this exactly what I was told? You can buy a counterfeit X-ray scanner, for example, that doesn't work. You have to check if it works in your hospital. So I think that it makes sense to have certain deployers have obligations, and those, as I said, you know, public institutions, it makes sense to check that when you use it in a specific context, right? For example, you use it in a very poor neighborhood to do social benefits, that you've also checked that the system is suited for the purpose of use. But most of the obligations are on the providers.
Yeah, let's not give the impression that the deployers are totally exempt from obligations. They need to put in place a system of compliance that is quite structured. Then last question, there is a bit of confusion on the timeline of the AI Act once published on the Official Gazette. I've seen different versions with different terms. Can you make a bit of clarity? And also maybe you can mention the AI Pact that seems to be a kind of a transitional regime until the AI.
Yeah, well, the reason you've seen different versions is because we have negotiated those, you know, and, you know, we got to different results until we had the final result. The final result is like this, you know, I hadn't mentioned, but it is worthy of mention, that in the AI Act, we have a certain number of uses of AI, doesn't matter what the system is, that we consider prohibited in the European Union, right? So, for example, assigning a social score to every single one of the European Union citizens and having negative decisions that have implications for those citizens or people in the Union, not just citizens, that impact them negatively, right? That's what China does. We don't want that. We don't want that type of mass control of the population in the Union. So there is a number of very limited practices that are outright prohibited. We don't want that in the Union. They don't fall within our system of values. We just don't want that. Those, they take into effect once the law is published within 6 months, because it makes sense. You can't do that in Europe, period. You know, even 3 months would have been okay. Even 1 month, we don't want that. Then I was mentioning briefly that we are addressing the big, powerful system, AI models. And there's a difference, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time. But the model is the brain. And the system is once you put something around the brain so that it can interact with the environment. Okay. So for models, and especially for powerful models, these evolve very, very fast. We've seen GPT, but there's also others. Again, you know, for those, we felt appropriate that the rules we set in place take effect within 12 months. 12 months, meaning that, you know, the companies will have time to look at the rules, which are not that strict, because they really monitor the systemic risks of such models. And within 12 months, we feel it's appropriate. Otherwise, you know, we're not keeping up with the developments. Then the big chunk of the AI Act covers the high-risk AI systems that we've discussed. Those will need to do more compliance work, indeed, to become safer to use and, as I said, more trustworthy. For those, we have 24 months to enter into compliance with the regulation. And then you have a special category of systems which are already embedded in products that are governed by other sectoral legislation. And there is an overlap between the AI Act and those sectoral legislations where we were trying to make sure it's simplified, we don't double regulate, and that we really cover just the AI component of, you know, whatever that product is. For those, because in some cases, the legislation, the sectoral legislation will need to be adapted, or the intersection between the two will need to be clarified, and because they're already made safer by their current sectoral legislation, we felt that 36 months would be appropriate. So that's basically the timeline, and there is a logic between each of them, although it seems more in phases. There is a logic to every one of the phases.
Yeah, good. And in the meantime, there will be in place the AI pact that is likely to be...
Oh, the pact, yes.
It proved before the end of the legislation, but it's a self-regulatory regime, is that right?
Exactly. So the pact is an initiative by the Commission. I think it's a very good initiative. I highly encourage all companies to follow it, where you voluntarily sign up and you exchange information with the help of the Commission to get into compliance by the time the AI Act comes into full effect. So that means you can sign up tomorrow and you start working on your compliance. By the time the law comes into effect and you need to be compliant, you had already done that compliance work and you get the support of the Commission in that. So I think it's a very good initiative that literally covers the gap between when we adopt the Act and when we start enforcing it. Those who actually sign up and follow and engage in the pact, I think they have a competitive advantage because it's going to be much easier to be compliant. And again, this applies to the high-risk AI systems and to the models that might have a systemic impact. It's not for your AI in agriculture, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Then you've been absolutely kind. I do believe that regardless of this timeline, companies cannot afford to wait until 24 months, 36 months to be compliant. Also because of the efforts in terms of time and investments to deploy an AI solution that meets the company's needs. So hope is that they're going to understand how they need to already start working on it. Then, thanks again for your time. It has been really useful. We appreciate all your work of the last years, and we just need to see the light, and then will be time to celebrate.